Illinois Senate is back in session early this week to start voting on budget bills. We've been hearing a lot about a grand bargain package. What's the status? We'll get the latest. And the president of Illinois State University, Larry Dietz, joins us to talk about how higher ed institutions are faring nearly 2 years into this budget crisis. Plus, how do Trump supporters in Illinois feel about the first 2 weeks of his presidency?
I'm really excited by some of the executive orders. He's taken action. He's not one of those politicians who are all talk. Donald Trump, the president of the United States, is a man of action, and that's what he's shown the American people.
We'll check in with Central Illinois resident Shane Bouvet. But first, over the weekend, a federal judge has suspended President Trump's immigration ban. What does this mean for people trying to get into Illinois? We'll get answers from a Chicago-based immigration lawyer, all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. It's February 6th. Lots going on today on the program. First, we wanted to catch you up on news over the weekend. Immigration orders originally put in place by President Trump last weekend were temporarily halted by a federal judge. The ban on immigrants from seven Muslim-majority nations and for refugees was suspended, and an appeal by the Trump administration to stay that decision was also denied. We're awaiting word today on what happens with the next level of appeals. The executive orders had meant that anywhere from 60,000 to 100,000 visas had been revoked. That number is not entirely clear at this point. But what does it all mean now for people trying to get into Illinois? This morning, the University of Illinois told us they're still advising people from affected countries to exercise caution when considering international travel and are still working directly with student, faculty and others who've been affected by the executive order. Chicago immigration attorney Michael Jarecki has been representing several clients affected by the executive orders. He's on the line with us now from Chicago. Hi, Mike. Welcome back to the 21st.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me.
So last night we saw that 97 tech companies, everyone from Google to Apple to Lyft, filed amicus briefs in support of overturning the ban. I wanted to ask you, the clients you're representing, what kind of work are they doing here in the U.S.?
So some of them are green card holders who have their own businesses, or you know, they can work as any other U.S. worker. Others are student visa holders who have received their degrees in the United States, and they're on a temporary work authorization following the education that they received in the United States to apply that knowledge to U.S. companies. And that's a lot in science, technology, engineering, and math, or STEM fields, which are highly desirable fields in the United States.
And from what's been happening with your clients since Friday night, are you seeing kind of more folks trying to get back into the country?
So if we just take a step back, a week ago on the 27th, we know the executive order was signed. That halted travel for anyone from the seven listed countries, and that included non-immigrant visas and immigrant visas. The lawful permanent residents were clarified to have been in the national interest, and they have been pretty much allowed to travel freely into the United States. During this past week, non-immigrants were still stuck outside of the United States because the Department of State unilaterally canceled their visas. The temporary restraining order of February 3rd by the U.S. District Court in the Western District of Washington reversed that, and the Department of State allowed for anyone's visas who were revoked or canceled to enter the United States. Customs and Border Protection also confirmed that individuals would be allowed entry into the United States if they were otherwise admissible. So what happened in the last couple of days is a huge mobilization of people who in the past week were denied boarding planes to come to the United States or who were stuck outside of the United States because they thought their visa was canceled. So the goal is to get as many people who already have approved visas that, again, were unilaterally revoked, but now they're back into effect into the United States, because an approved visa holder is somebody who has already gone through the U.S. government's process for an application and they received an approval. That also suggests that they went through security clearance through the United States government and the procedures that were in place. Some of these non-immigrant visa holders were just outside of the United States temporarily because they were already in the United States as workers, temporary workers, or as students. And that is the significant harm that the judge in Washington found to the state and the states that were represented in that litigation, was that individuals who were already in the United States, would the state's residents would be affected in areas of employment, education, business, family relations, and freedom of travel. And those are all the things that we're seeing not only in Illinois, but across the country. And this temporary restraining order was a nationwide temporary restraining order, so it affected, you know, everyone's visas who were canceled. So anyone could get into the United States, not just going through a port of entry in Washington, but they could do so at O'Hare, and we saw that occurring. What's scary about this is just by nature of the actual word, temporary restraining order, it's temporary.
Right.
As you mentioned, the government has already challenged that. It was appealed to the Ninth Circuit, and the judge allowed it, allowed the stay or the temporary restraining order to go in because there's a significant public interest and a harm, and the judge even said the state or the residents would suffer irreparable harm if he did not slow this down, this order, put a pause on it, and allow for an explanation or, you know, litigation on the merits to happen from both sides.
And when you, so when we say that, when you, I'm just curious, and I know it sounds like there's a lot of things in flux now. We've seen over the past week and a half, things are changing on a very fast, sort of on a very fast basis. But I was wondering when you, I've read stories about people who, like the folks who were in the air when the policy was established and then they landed here and then they were considered in violation. They said, some people said they were forced to sign forms saying that they violated immigration law and that therefore
Correct.
They couldn't enter the country for a few years. Do we know what happens with those people now?
So those people need to sort of come forward and try to clear up, if possible, the cancellation of their visa. So you're exactly right that there were people, and this was the chaos and the crisis of last weekend, there were people who were in midair traveling from international destinations into the United States when the executive order was first signed. And Customs and Border Protection, the agency that's in charge at the airport to allow people to come into the United States or to stop them if they're not, if they don't have valid documentation or a valid reason to be here, those people who were presenting non-immigrant visas were seen as not having the correct travel documentation, even though they, in good faith, traveled to the United States, had the approved visa. The rules were changed on them in midstream, and they were not given notice, and they were treated as if they didn't have the proper documentation. There were a limited amount of case-by-case waivers that were able to be applied to individuals, but we heard, as you mentioned, of very draconian steps and steps that then created if people did not want to sign away their right or withdraw their admission to come to the United States, created a bar such that the government would engage in an expedited removal of that person, and that person would be subjected to a bar of several years from ever being able to come back into the country. So those individuals need to contact a lawyer. Those cases need to percolate potentially up to the courts and quickly, because what occurred to them was something that was the facts and the law of last week. And now if they were traveling, that would be a different situation for them. So where possible, that needs to be undone, and those people need to see if they could apply for a visa again because it wasn't their fault. You know, individuals were did not, in Customs and Border Protection, have a right to counsel. So they were getting both their legal advice from the same purse government official whose interest it is to try to keep that person outside of the United States. And as a legal community, you know, we're extremely offended by that. We're obviously taking a look at that, especially the class of individuals who were originally held who were lawful permanent resident green card holders, which is really one step under a U.S. citizen. They don't have
so
a right to
Mike,
vote.
It's, so what are you telling clients now? I mean, it's just it seems like it's difficult to provide legal advice right now. What are you saying to folks?
Right. I mean, we want to move forward rationally, but we want to move forward with precaution. So if you're outside of the United States and you're from one of these seven countries, if you're outside of the United States and you have your refugee documents that approve you to come to the United States, you need to find a way and get on a flight immediately and come to the United States because the temporary restraining order, if it is halted could put into effect some of the elements of the executive order barring these people from coming in. If the court case is won eventually, those people might receive a green light to come back, but we don't know. There's too much uncertainty, so where possible, people need to try to come back to the United States from the seven countries. If you're in the United States and you're from one of those seven countries, I would think twice before traveling abroad. It's very precarious, especially if you're on a non-immigrant visa. If you're a green card holder and you're a passport holder, citizen or national of one of those seven countries, you have a more of a better chance of traveling internationally and coming back in, because the Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security has said green card holders are in the national interest to return to the United States. But these individuals can still be subjected to extreme screening in secondary inspection at the airport. And at that time, the government could look through people's luggage, look through people's cell phones and electronics, their social media, to see if there's any anti-American sentiment in this person's background, and potentially move to not admit them to the United States. So anything that people are going to do, I think they should get in touch with organizations that work in an immigration sphere or an immigration attorney to understand what their rights are and understand what this rapidly changing environment means to them at the moment when they're going to make that decision.
And what's the scene been like? I know you've spent a lot of time at O'Hare in the past week and a half. What has it been like at O'Hare this past weekend? Are we seeing lots of people trying to come in and book those flights as soon as possible?
Right. My understanding is we're seeing full flights coming into the United States from key international destinations where people from the seven countries would be traveling from. But in reality, some of these people are traveling from destinations such as Mexico because they decided to go on a vacation when this happened, yet they may be from a country in the Middle East. But we are seeing long wait times to come through customs, both U.S. citizens and other immigrant and non-immigrant visa holders. But we're seeing we're seeing a much more smooth process, and we're not seeing people denied or held in ways that we saw one weekend before. So that's a relief. It is true from our experience that the information is truly trickling down as to what this temporary restraining order means and what the obligations of the government are in not sidestepping the court and still putting in effect the executive order. So we're hopeful that because of the courts, things are calm at this time. But also, this court case is a live court case.
It's an ongoing court case. Right. We'll see what happens today.
Correct.
As well with that. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us. Michael
Jarecki
is a Chicago attorney and immigration attorney based in Chicago. Michael, thanks for being with us.
Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Two weeks into Donald Trump's presidency, we thought we'd check back in with a man from Central Illinois who got to meet the president in person at the inauguration. Shane Bouvet is a resident of Stonington. That's a rural town southeast of Springfield, and the social media coordinator for Team Trump Grassroots in Illinois. And Shane received a generous gift from the president to thank him for his work as a volunteer on the campaign. He's on the line with us from Stonington. Hey, Shane, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So, Shane, last time we spoke with you, I'm great. You were really excited about attending your first inauguration. How did it go?
Oh, well, I feel like I'm still living in a dream, to be honest with you. I never thought in a million years I'd meet the president of the United States. And, you know, I just wake up so blessed. And, you know, it's crazy how it all happened. You know, the Washington Post ended up grabbing onto my story. And I guess they interviewed a lot of people. And, you know, they asked, well, Shane, what do you want out of it? I said, I just did it for America. I wasn't expecting anything out of it. I did it because I love my country and I'm proud of my country and I want to make it great again. You talk to the guys at the coffee shop and you know, they talk about how engines roared and people were put back to work, and I'm really not happy with things I see, especially within my district. So, you know, Donald Trump was that fresh breath of air to me and to our communities. And that's how I kind of got involved.
And so by it, let's remind everybody, you took it upon yourself during the campaign to be to start social media work for the Trump campaign. And that's what sort of led to you then eventually getting the invitation to the inauguration and things like that. That's what you meant by kind of all of the work that you did over the past 9 months, right?
Yeah, I had an actress get a hold of me and said, Shane, I'd like to invite you to the inaugural ball. I've seen some of your work on Facebook. And that's kind of how it happened. So an actress ended up getting a hold of me, and I ended up going with her to the inaugural ball. And I guess Donald Trump ended up reading it in the Washington Post and was touched by the story. And I don't know if it was Kellyanne Conway or one of his staff members said, hey, would you like to talk to Donald Trump? And I just started stuttering because I was like, am I getting ready to talk to Donald Trump?
And this was about half an hour, right, before he was officially sworn in. What did you guys talk about?
Well, we ended up talking about, we had 30 minutes of private time, and we just talked about a lot of things in America. And, you know, he's just a generous, loving, caring person. He really is. And it's just a total disgrace on how the media is portraying him, because that is not he's just a great guy. He really is. And he cares about America. He's putting America first, or making America safe again. And, you know, and at the end of the day, you know, it's all about America first. And it's sad how some of these people are trying to portray him in the media. I think it's a total disgrace. So, you know, he's just such a generous, caring, loving guy. And you know, I think people who met him personally will truly understand that. And he's just such a great guy.
You know, we have to take a break, but when we come back, I want you to expand on that, what it was like for you to meet him personally, what you want people to know about how caring he is. Again, we're speaking with Stonington resident Shane Bouvet. Stonington's about 30 miles southeast of Springfield. We're talking to him about his time with President Trump at the inauguration. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st.
The 21st is made possible by
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Right now, my guest is Shane Bouvet. His day job is a FedEx courier. He lives in Stonington. That's about 30 miles southeast of Springfield. When he's not at work, he has been working for Donald Trump, and that was rewarded during the inauguration. He's just been telling us about the time, the half-an-hour conversation he had with President Trump in person before he was officially sworn in. Shane, you said you feel like President Trump has been unfairly portrayed. You feel like you want people to know what a warm and caring person he is. I know he had you call your dad, who's been suffering from cancer from some time now. That I'm sure that meant a lot to you and to your dad. Is that what you meant by him?
Oh, yeah. Well, it gave him that extra fight. And, you know, it's just, you hear some things in the media that I feel like is totally not true. Usually when you go give somebody a hug and they hug you back, that's a sign of love and compassion, and they really care as a person. And when I met Donald Trump, we gave each other a hug. And I gave him a bear hug, but, you know, and he gave one back. And, you know, that means that it's just, he's just a truly genuine, caring, loving person. He really is. At heart, he did this for America. He didn't have to do this. And, you know, he's a multi-billionaire. He doesn't have to do this, but he did this because he loves America.
Well, and I know
America first. And
you said, right, you voted for him because you feel like he's a man of action. Certainly, there's been a lot of action in the first 2 weeks of his presidency. For you, how have you thought things? How would you describe how things have gone for the past few weeks?
We're getting things done. I mean, most politicians, if you look at Illinois, we're not doing that great as a state. And, you know, Donald Trump is a man of his word, and when he says he's going to do something, he does it. You know, and like that check, you go send him a $10,000 check. It came Monday. He is a man of his word. He brings a fresh air to politics. These people are hurting. When I was running for state representative, going door to door, and these people can't put food on the table for their kids and things like that. It's sad. And we have manufacturing capital of Illinois, Decatur. I mean, we're losing jobs, and I think that all these politicians are all talk, no action, and I'm just tired of what I'm seeing. And Donald Trump is a fresh air to politics. We're going to drain the swamp, and I'm just blessed to be a part of it.
What actions in particular are you most excited about that he's done?
Put America safety first.
executive orders. I'm, you know, he's getting things done. I don't really want to go into policy, but he's getting things done. You know, he's a man of action, and it clearly shows.
And I want to go back to when you said that, just one quick question about the Making America Safe. Do you mean in particular, I'm wondering if you're talking in particular about the immigration ban. And I just wanted to ask you about that one, just that one in particular, just because we were just talking to an immigration attorney who was talking about sort of the irreparable harm he feels like is being done to the U.S. by keeping people who have green cards and people who've already been vetted from coming in. You don't see it that way.
No, I think that America comes first. And I think that a lot of these veterans feel the same way as I do. You know, we got to, it's America, we got to put our own people up first. And we're going to make it safe again. It's going to be a beautiful thing. And if he just sits back, and even that attorney, he will see a beautiful thing happen in the United States. It's going to be beautiful. Trust me. It's going to be great. And, you know, I think he's going to be one of the best presidents. He's getting things done. All these, you know, he's a man of action, and he clearly shows that. And we're going to make it safe. And I mean, like I said, he's going to make America safe again.
And Shane, just want to follow up. You did say President Trump said he was going to send you a personal check to thank you for the work that you did. You said you got that in the mail last week. That was $10,000. What did it mean for you to receive that?
Yeah. Oh, I was just blessed. You know, I really was. I'm just blessed. I wake up every day just blessed. I mean, for what he did for my dad, gave him that extra fight. So I can't thank him enough from the bottom of my heart. And my dad's a military veteran. And, you know, so him going out of his way to do that, that's just amazing. And that just really shows his character as a person.
I want to thank Shane Bouvet for coming back on the show. Shane, thanks for coming back and updating us and sharing the story about your time with President Trump and the check that he gave you to say thanks for all the work you did for him, too. Take care, Shane. Thanks.
No, thank you so much. Yeah, thank you so much.
This week, lawmakers are back in Springfield, back on the table in the Senate, at least, bills aimed at resolving the budget impasse. A reminder, we're almost 2 years into this. Later in the hour, we're going to be hearing from Illinois State University President Larry Dietz about how state higher education institutions are faring. There's lots going on in state politics this week. We're joined now by two political reporters to fill us in on the latest. On the line from Springfield, Matt Dietrich is the editor of Reboot Illinois. On the line from WBEZ in Chicago, Tony Arnold is with us. He covers politics for WBEZ. Matt, Tony, welcome back to the 21st.
Thanks, Nyla.
Thanks.
Tony, can I just ask you, just because we were just talking to Shane Bouvet, and I just wonder how much you think he represents. It's interesting to hear him talk about his interactions with President Trump. You know, I've had previous conversations with him where he's expressed frustration at you heard him talk about not just lawmakers here, but Republican lawmakers here. I wonder how much he represents maybe the face of new Republicans in Illinois or Trump Republicans who aren't at all connected to the establishment. Just curious your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think just in hearing what Shane was just saying just now, I think he does resemble a lot of the Trump supporters in Illinois, but not necessarily the elected Republicans in Illinois. I think that there's a big distinction between the way that Shane's been talking about President Trump and supporting him versus...
say Governor Rauner?
you can go down a whole list of elected Republicans. It's not just Governor Rauner who's holding Trump at kind of arm's length on several issues. So it's there is a divide within the party. It's been there since the campaign. The party itself and the chairman of the state Republican Party, Tim Schneider, has been pretty consistent in supporting Trump since he became the official nominee of the GOP during the campaign and over the last 2 weeks as well. But other elected officials, from U.S. congressmen to the governor to even state representatives, have been and state senators have been kind of all over the map, depending on geography and just where Trump did well, kind of embodies, I think, how different Republicans, elected Republicans, have taken their stand on the president.
Yeah, let's focus on state politics for a minute. And I know you've been reporting on how Governor Rauner has been handling the first 2 weeks of President Trump in the White House. What's your sense of how Governor Rauner is trying to be a Republican governor and be a member of the Republican Party, but then also, I don't know if you would say, you think it's accurate to say that he's sort of doing a balancing act? He's trying to sort of distance himself a little bit from President Trump. How would you characterize the situation?
Yeah, I think that's right. If you look at just this, the travel ban executive order that the president signed a week and a half ago, in looking at Governor Rauner's response to that, it was a written statement. He's not really addressed it much more beyond that, and basically saying that there's serious concerns with it. The governor supported limiting the number of Syrian refugees specific to Syria, just Syria, as opposed to other countries as well. How many of them would come to Illinois in the past? That was about a year and a half ago he addressed that issue. But otherwise, he just says that this is really something that the courts should be looking at. So it kind of thread the line there about not fully saying, no, I don't support it, but without coming out strongly against it as well. Aside from that, Rauner has talked about the importance of making sure that the state can get along and has relationships with federal officials. And Rauner constantly talks about how he had friends in the Obama administration, in addition to he has friends in the Trump administration. Mainly Vice President Mike Pence is who he's referring to, although there's been some aides that have worked with Rauner in the past.
Right. So kind of right. He sort of wants to emphasize Illinois still has ties to the White House, it sounds like. Can I ask you one more question about this sort of on the immigration? We saw some news this morning about Illinois lawmakers working towards some legislation that would make the state more of a so-called sanctuary. And I just thought it was interesting data when you look at Illinois' nearly 13 million residents, close to 1.8 are foreign born. What do you know, have a sense of what Illinois lawmakers are trying to propose that would maybe counteract what the executive orders or other sort of maybe preempt other action on immigration that the federal government may be taking?
Sure. There's some new legislation. It's only been introduced. These things tend to change significantly from the time that they're introduced to being passed, if they're even passed. So they take this all with a large grain of salt because this is brand new. But there's a few new pieces of legislation being proposed by Democrats who have liked to say that Rauner is, you know, fleeing from President Trump or trying to distance himself as far away as much as he can. So just know that that's kind of the political backdrop to these proposals. But one would basically say that federal immigration authorities could not go into schools, places of worship, churches, hospitals, things like that. It would bar them, immigration authorities, from going into those places to detain people. And then another proposal would limit the amount of communication that goes on between federal immigration authorities and local police or local security officials. But that's what's just right now out there. That doesn't mean that these even get a hearing. We'll see how far the state legislature wants to go with some of these issues.
That's WBEZ's Tony Arnold. Reboot Illinois' Matt Dietrich is with us as well. Matt, let's move on to budget issues. There's sort of a package of these 13 bills we've been talking about for a couple weeks here aimed at bringing an end to the state's ongoing budget impasse. What's the plan for this week with the Senate? What do you think is going to be voted on?
2 weeks ago when the Senate adjourned, Senate President John Cullerton and Senate Republican leader Christine Rodogno both told their members as the from the Senate floor, when you come back on February 7th, be ready to vote on these. So I think what the plan is that we will see committee hearings at which votes will be taken. Now, 2 weeks ago, we did have some committee hearings on several of these bills in which there was a lot of opponents showed up to talk about why they didn't like the tax bill.
Minimum wage.
All this kind of stuff, and but those were strictly subject matter hearings. There was no vote taken to push those to the Senate floor for a vote. What the plan is this week is that we would actually see votes on these bills, and you know, what everyone has to keep in mind is there are 13 bills here. If one of these bills does not pass in the Senate, they all die. So what we'll see this week is I'm kind of hopeful that we'll see some action, some votes to push this before the full Senate to get an actual floor vote to see if we, you know, if this framework is going to advance.
Tony, what's your sense of the legislative process here in terms of having a framework? Do you see this as we maybe have a framework that we can have a discussion with people, that maybe the Senate can kind of put this forward? We haven't even gotten to the House yet. What's your sense of the movement on this?
I think my sense is that the Senate is thinking about let's just send a message that the Senate over here, this chamber,
we can
work together,
something.
Republicans and Democrats, we can actually get something negotiated and passed. And I think that the thinking is that would signal compromise is possible in Springfield, which is something that's not been there for a long time now. So on these big issues, at least. So I think that that's kind of the driving motivation right now. That said, to Matt's point, there's 13 major proposals, and we still don't have language, official language, introduced on a couple of them. It's going to be interesting to see how many of these proposals still make the cut by the end of the week, or by the time that the votes are supposed to be taking place here. Some of the big ones that don't have language yet would be how schools get state money. Another one is raising the minimum wage. These are two big ones that don't have language right now, and so we're still kind of waiting to see, are they part of the package anymore? Did they get cut out?
Right, because that's a possibility, right, Matt? I mean, is Tony saying that all 13, because 13 into zero seems like a very tall standard to set for, and do you have it? So it does sound like, as Tony's saying, do we have a sense that maybe some of these will now be winnowed down to the things that they're really can find agreement on from a bipartisan basis?
If you talk to the leaders, the Senate leaders, Christine Rodogno and John Cullerton, and some of the other senators who are part of this, what you'll hear from them is that this, you absolutely cannot look at this like we heard a couple weeks ago. You know, you saw some headlines about, oh, the wheels are coming off the cart of this Senate deal. It's falling apart. And what they've emphasized all along is, hey, look, we're just putting this out there. And it's going to change, and it's going to change a lot. The minimum wage is one good example where it was out there. The minimum wage was going to go up this year, and up for the next couple years it would get up to $11. And then suddenly 2 weeks ago an amendment was added to that bill, and it looked like that might be pulled out of the package. You know, the amendment hasn't been acted on. The bill is still there. It's kind of in limbo. And I think all of these things are in limbo. But like Tony said, you know, the biggest bill, in my opinion, that could derail the whole process is this school funding bill. That's huge. That's been an issue in Illinois for 20 years. And, of course, the issue is because we rely so heavily on property taxes, on local property taxes, to fund our local school districts, the districts that don't have that much property tax wealth they get commensurately less school funding. Their schools are, you know, you have downstate districts, rural districts where there's high schools that don't even offer foreign languages. And then you have the more affluent parts of the state where there is immense property tax wealth and they have the finest education facilities and programs in the country.
Matt, I'm going to stop you there. We're going to talk.
Sure.
You're talking about K-12 funding. We're going to take a break.
Exactly.
When we come back, we're actually going to have a conversation about higher ed funding with the president of ISU. Larry Dietz is going to be on the line with us from Normal. I want to thank Matt Dietrich and Tony Arnold for joining me to talk about Illinois politics. We'll pick up this conversation with Matt in just a few minutes. Thanks, Tony. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. You can always follow us on Twitter, by the way. 21ST shows our handle. During the show, we live tweet other background and analysis on the conversations we're talking about. When we're not on the air, you can follow us for the latest Illinois news. So that's 21ST show on Twitter. If you want us to ask questions or if you want to comment on the conversation, you're always welcome to join us there as well. So you can tweet there. My guest is Matt Dietrich. He's the editor of Reboot Illinois. Matt, just before the break, we were just talking about school funding, the K-12 formula, how unfair that is. And I know that there was a report that came out from the Illinois School Funding Reform Commission late last week. What exactly did the report say?
The report more or less reiterated that we do have a problem. And it made some suggestions about things to be changed. The problem is we've had so many of these reports, and we kind of know what the problems are. And what we need at this point, and especially right now, given this budget package that we were talking about, what we need is a bill that shows exactly how are we going to redistribute the state's portion of education funding, and how are we going to make it so that what typically happens is the more affluent school districts, they pay state taxes too, so they don't like having education money taken away from them to give to poor students, and then they have to make up for it with even higher property taxes.
And I think, Matt, I feel like we've been having this conversation for years, right? And have we gotten, and I know this is something, Senator Andy Menar has been working on for actually years as well.
Right.
I mean, are we at all closer to, do you feel like this report, is it more of the same, or are we at all closer to getting any kind of consensus from lawmakers about how we can fix this?
Well, I think what this report does is it kind of lays out some talking points in advance of creating an actual bill that people can vote on. And they had this bipartisan commission that had lawmakers on it. Now you do have in the Senate, they've got these other dozen bills that have language that the Republican and Democratic leadership agreed on. You're going to have to now do that same thing on school funding. And one of the problems is it's going to take several billion dollars to hold harmless the school districts that aren't going to receive, that are going to receive a lower percentage of state funding. And there's an issue, obviously, we don't have a budget. We have no new revenue coming in. We don't know where that would come from. The other thing is there's also an issue, and John Cullerton brought this up in a committee hearing 2 weeks ago. There are a lot of school districts in the state that have pretty large cash reserves that they're sitting on, and it seems like there might be a movement to pry some of that loose to make it less harmful if state funding goes down slightly. A lot of these districts, a lot of the more affluent districts, aren't nearly as reliant on state funding as a percentage of their total budget, since they, typically 60% of a school district's budget comes from property taxes. It can be higher.
That's Reboot Illinois' Matt Dietrich, editor of Reboot Illinois. Matt, always great to have you. Thank you. We've been talking about K-12 funding. Let's turn to higher education. Ahead of next week's budget address by the governor, we want to check in with some of the groups most affected by the budget crisis. Our state's public colleges and universities have seen just a fraction of the money they expected in the last fiscal year. Some campuses resorted to layoffs. Programs have been cut. Grants for lower-income students have been put at risk. The president of Southern Illinois University, for one, says their campus, their university, is running on fumes. Larry Dietz is president of Illinois State University in Normal, and he joins us now from the studios of WGLT, our partner station in Bloomington Normal. President Dietz, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being with us this morning.
Well, thank you for having me. My pleasure.
Now, you wear at least two hats in all of these ongoing budget discussions. Obviously, president of ISU, you've stressed that the campus is strong and stable. I want to get back to that. I want to get to that in a minute, but I want to start with your role as the convener of a statewide group of university presidents and chancellors. Garrett, given what you've been hearing from all of these campus leaders, What do you want the governor to know? What do you want lawmakers to know about the state of higher education in Illinois at this moment right now?
Well, it's the same message that we've been sending, I think, for essentially the last year and a half, nearly 2 years now, that we haven't had a budget, and that is higher education is certainly worthy of the investment of state dollars. We're doing what we can to educate the sons and daughters of citizens of the state who expect a quality education for their sons and daughters, and we want to continue to provide that. But this impasse has really created a crisis of confidence, in my estimation, about leadership throughout the state, both of the elected officials and then also because of lack of budget, also related to higher education in the state of Illinois. As a result of that, this past fall, we saw 16,000 students leave the state of Illinois to go to other states to pursue their higher education because they didn't think that the state was going to come up with money. So our message is, has been clear. We want to cooperate. We understand the governor and the elected officials. Other elected officials are in a tough bind in terms of overall state budget, but education, we think, is certainly worthy of an investment, given that the companies and other not-for-profits and other organizations within the state want to hire graduates who, by definition, will make more money and pay more taxes and be a part of the solution.
President Dietz, as we think ahead to next Wednesday's budget address, certainly we've heard those same sentiments addressed from Governor Rauner. He says that education is important and it's a priority from him. So what are you going to be listening for next Wednesday?
Well, I had the good fortune of speaking with the governor in late December. I met with him personally in his office, and as you might guess, he did say that he was supportive of education, and I believe that. I believe that a lot of the elected officials are also supportive of higher education, but the budgetary issues right now are highly politicized, as I think everyone knows, but we're hopeful that both the governor will send a signal that of compromise and cooperation and conciliation. We hope that he'll hear the same back from other elected officials in the state so we can move on beyond this impasse and the confidence issue that it's created to something that's more successful.
How have you and your counterparts at other universities been ramping up efforts to push not just, it sounds like you've talked to the governor, but other lawmakers towards some sort of compromise? Because certainly the government said the lawmakers should be putting forth their budget ideas. Democratic legislators have said, no, this is the governor's responsibility to create the budget. How are you all trying to navigate that? Is this, it's kind of, I guess, a little unusual. You're having to reach out to everybody.
Well, and we've been doing that ever since the budget impasse began. We've been doing it collectively in terms of the overall group of public university presidents have been to Springfield numerous times. We've met with legislative leaders there as well as the governor on various occasions. So we've been pushing that message, and then individual presidents representing their own institutions and their own districts have been meeting with those individuals as well within their districts. So we think that they know the issues. It's just a matter of getting together and trying to figure out you know, how to approach this, both from a revenue enhancement perspective and also a cutting perspective. We've all experienced the cuts that have occurred in really draconian style over the course of this last year and currently for FY17. But we're hopeful that you know, some of the proposals that are out there will gain some support and we can move on.
Yeah, one of those proposals we've seen at least floated in the Senate would have funded the ideas to fund higher education at fiscal 15 levels. Again, if that passes, that would still be some cuts compared to what we've seen before, but certainly an improvement over last year where most state universities got, you know, at best minimal funding. What's your assessment of what's being proposed right now in the Senate for higher education funding?
Well, I think the FY 2015 would be a great start. It would be a good building block to you know, begin to have additional discussions about FY16. We're still paying bills for FY16, and I know that the appropriation that came in June was viewed as FY17 money, but we had everybody, all the higher education had bills that were still outstanding from 16, and most have used that money to pay FY16 bills. Every institution gets a little bump in their revenue whenever they start a semester. So fall semester started with new enrollments, and institutions got a little bit of a revenue bump then. Same thing happened at the start of the spring semester. But if some action is not taken, my sense is that we're going to be back to this, rush to the cliff kind of idea sometime in March or April, and I think everybody wants to avoid that.
I'm speaking with President Larry Dietz. He's the president of Illinois State University in Normal. And you mentioned, President Dietz, that 16,000 number of students who chose other schools outside of Illinois. You've talked about this crisis of confidence in higher education. And when I think about it, ISU, the University of Illinois, has seen increased enrollment. Other campuses have not seen that. How do you convince high school juniors and seniors that despite this crisis, they'll still receive a good education at Illinois public universities?
Well, Illinois for decades has had a strong reputation as having a quality educational system, both at K-12 as well as higher education. I did my undergraduate work a long time ago in the state of Illinois, but probably at that time, Illinois was in the top, I'd say, five or six states in the nation in terms of their support of higher education. Unfortunately, I think, is probably not the case now. But I think that at Illinois State, our brand has been strong, and I think we've remained strong and stable due to our enrollments and low debt and careful spending and really our strong brand. But I think, the other institutions, while there's been a bit of a setback in enrollment for some of those institutions, they're still providing the high-quality education that they've been providing. It's just that they're providing it to fewer students who are making other decisions, and as a result of that, many have had to also lay off staff and curtail some academic programs. So in my estimation, what we really need to do is to get back and have a more serious conversation about what should the role of higher education be in the state of Illinois versus going through this budget impasse, which has the a strangulation effect on many institutions, and that really doesn't serve the students well, it doesn't serve the institutions well, and ultimately doesn't serve the state well.
Well, and including your undergraduate institution, Southern Illinois University, their president, Randy Dunn, recently said Southern was running on fumes. I know you've stressed throughout the budget crisis that ISU is strong and stable, but the school still had to cut spending by $11 million and cut or left vacant more than 100 non-faculty positions. What happens to you all come March or April if there's no budget?
Well, we're going to continue. There's no question about that. We will continue to finish out this academic year, and we're going to be making plans for this next year. One demographic in the state is just a fact that we can't get around, and that is that the number of students who are graduating from high schools in the state of Illinois are declining. And so that creates its own challenge with or without this impasse. So when you add the impasse to that, that adds another challenge that institutions are having to deal with this credibility issue with the public at large. But we're strong and stable. We're going to continue to be open. We have not entered into any kind of conversations about that have been brought up frequently about, well, when are institutions going to close? That, to me, is the wrong question. The question is, what is the value of higher education in the state of Illinois? And I think for all the higher educational institutions, that value is very strong. We are graduating students at a good rate. They're getting jobs. They're getting well-paying jobs. And for those individuals who leave the state for their education, the probability of them coming back to the state of Illinois for a job is diminished. And so not only are we losing those tax dollars, but we're also losing the academic potential of those individuals to start their businesses in Illinois, et cetera. So it really doesn't make a very good sense from a business perspective, let alone an educational perspective, to continue to allow those students to vote with their feet and cross state lines.
Larry Dietz is president of Illinois State University in Normal, joining us from our partner station, WGLT. President Dietz, thanks for taking the time to speak with us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We're out of time today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app if you search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. All of those links, every other way to contact us if you want to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, follow us on social media. All of that information is at our website, 21stshow.org. By the way, you can also search for us on Facebook, search for The 21st, and like us there. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.